Hello and welcome back for another special analysis episode of The Storyteller, Violent Delights. And bar something really dramatic happening, this will be the last. I promise I don't deliberately say this is the end, and I know it's not. I genuinely didn't know if this conversation could happen or not because my guest has been busy away filming and fully immersed in a role. Yes, it is award-winning actor Kate Dickie. From Red Road to Hollywood, she's got almost as many IMDb entries than the late, great Sir Sean Connery. That's a true fact. She has 91. Sean has three more. You'll have seen her on the big and small screens in Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Prometheus, Peaky Blinders, and many others. And she has 9 new projects being released in the near future. Not only is she an amazing actor, she's a thoroughly fantastic human being with a huge heart, a passion for storytelling, and in particular, giving women a voice. Well, lucky for me, she was a fan of the first series, The Storyteller, Murder Most Foul, and I jumped around with joy in my PJs during lockdown when she agreed via Twitter to be the voice of Sheila Garvey. As an actor, she's not someone who just delivers lines. She likes to get to know her character, and this was no exception, as you'll hear. I invited her on now for a chat because I was dying to hear how she felt about Sheila after hearing the full story from all those involved. And we had not discussed it until this conversation. So once again, get the kettle on, because this is a long one. I'm absolutely delighted to be speaking now to Kate Dickie, the voice of Sheila Garvey, who I've already expressed, I think, at the end of every episode, how honoured and touched I was that you took on her voice. But I think people might be interested to know how that came about and how, yeah, you and I connected in the beginning, which is we actually met physically, but at an awards thing where you don't really get to chat to someone 500 years ago, I think.
Yeah, it feels like 500 years ago. Yeah, I remember Kenny and me meeting you. I think it was at one of the BAFTA awards. It does feel like many moons ago, but we came home that night and we were just like, Ayla. We thought you were just so cool. And we remember sitting with you and having such a good laugh. And yeah, it was a really nice connection. And then actually, how we've now reconnected is because I basically was a fan of your first series of The Storyteller, Murder Most Foul, and I was really taken by your very sensitive and very factual way of reporting, and how you really brought Melanie as a person out of what was just a terrible, awful murder, you know? And it wasn't a story I'd been familiar with, so I got to know Melanie's story through you, and I think I tweeted about it quite a few times, just saying, oh wow, this series, you know, Isla's an amazing reporter, and I loved your style. And so that's how we connected. So when you approached me about doing a voice for Sheila, I felt that I didn't actually think twice about it, because I knew that I trusted your reporting, and I knew that if you were telling another woman's story, that you would be looking at, you know, the facts and looking beyond what can be quite at the time salacious headlines and, you know, what we would now call clickbait. But at the time, you know, there was a lot of, it appears there was a lot of kind of furore about the whole kind of, you know, more dark and kind of sordid side that Max got Sheila involved in. So yeah, that's a long way around of me saying that, yeah, I basically started off as a fan of you, Isla, and yeah, it was really an honour to be involved in Violent Delights. It really was.
Well, this is a
real mutual appreciation society, because obviously I've been a big fan of you for a long time. And I remember when your tweet came through, I'm like, oh my God, Kate Dickey's just tweeted. And I told Susan, I'm like, Kate Dickey's just tweeted about Murder Most Foul. Aww. Susan, of course, being the mother of Melanie, yeah, as I'm sure listeners will know. But and Susan's story as well was one that touched you. And that was, I mean, the reason for me, as well as it being the first case that I ever did and one that had troubled me, was Melanie as a person had just not been present in that story. It was was literally name, age, occupation, and then a photo. I think it was a passport photo that they put up, which, you know, and I felt that there was more, I knew more about her, obviously from covering the story, and I wanted to just dig deeper. But also I had this knowledge of Susan. I knew where Susan was at all these years later. I knew it was something that still bothered her, and it was really important to me. So I'm so grateful that you listened to Murder Most Foul and were a champion of it. And and you're right, when I texted you, I was like, it was on Twitter, I was like, in private messages, I'm like, would you do this? And you came back immediately and you just said, I don't think you even knew anything about it, you're just like, yes.
Yeah, so, it was immediate,
Yeah. And then, of course, I had to explain that I don't get paid to do this and I can't pay you anything. And I hate asking anyone, particularly in the arts, to do anything for free, which we often do. And I was, you know, I was so touched that you had to, and during COVID, you had to go to the effort. You went away to a cinema, is that right,
well,
to record
actually,
it?
Actually, I mean, you know, if I'd had more time, I probably would have worked on like an accent for Sheila, and, you know, but in a short time, and also with COVID, I was kind of going to just put it on in like my bedroom where I am now, but we can have like a really meowing cat, and there was like roadworks going on outside. And so I ended up being able to go to the theatre at the CCA because Kenny, my partner's the technical manager there. And so I was like, please, can, you know, is there a quiet space? So he was great. He got me a space. And because when, you know, you'd approach me about The Voice and I'd said, yes, absolutely. When I actually looked at the story, I was like, oh, like Sheila deserves some care and TLC and not just kind of throwing a voice down to, you know, do a favour. And like I said, if I'd had more time or it been, you know, out of COVID or we'd been able to, you know, work together, I would have tried to have maybe embodied her as a character as such. But my like overriding thing was her story speaking the loudest, what had happened, her experiences, and I didn't want a distraction of maybe me not doing a good enough accent or trying to make her some kind of character when actually, you know, she was a real live breathing person that these things happened to. So I went and just recorded it as kind of plainly as I could, just to give her a voice. And like you, I feel like I'm a storyteller as an actor, and I have a kind of duty as an actor to tell stories, and not always stories that are easy to listen to, you know. That was kind of how I approached it and why I approached it the way I did, which was kind of trying to keep it quite plain, because when I looked at it, you know, there was talk of her not being emotional at the trial and keeping herself very together. And so I felt it would be wrong to try and dramatise something that was already dramatic enough and it's very sad details.
And I'd like to point out as well, I specifically said that I didn't want you to burden yourself with trying to do an accent. I really didn't feel it was important. Do you know what was more important? You captured her essence, which you did so beautifully. The only people that would know that you didn't have the correct Scottish accent for that area is the people in Scotland listening. And again, I don't think anyone cares, because what you did in portraying her was so incredible. And also, I'd love the listener to know that, you know, I said, I first of all said, could you read a few lines from the court transcript? And then that obviously grew a little bit. And then I sent it to you and I kept saying, if you don't have time, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. And when I got that text from you where you said, the actor in me will not let me do this without knowing more. I want to get under her skin. And that was just warmed my soul. And then prompted us to have a 2-3 hour conversation, was it, about it?
Yeah.
And I told you everything. And so you did, you went in with the deep knowledge. But then, of course, as you're going through the process, is that there was a difference between the stage you're at when you're reading and then, of course, when you were then listening to the podcast, hearing all the other pieces of the jigsaw. But can I just focus on the pieces that I sent to you? Because they were powerful. I mean, even her words in court, even her statement to the police, never mind the poetry that's in her book. What did you glean of her character from reading her words?
She was someone who was very aware of how that people perceived her, you know, and she, it was almost like she was in, to me anyway, was in this, like she held herself to, she couldn't have won in the court trial. If she'd portrayed a lot of emotion, she would have probably been portrayed as someone who was being fake and making it all about her and being this kind of, you know, attention seeking. And so I really felt for her because a lot of it you could see she deliberately kept herself very together and didn't let people in. And I mean, my overriding thing when you gave me, you know, when I first read, you know, and printed off what you'd sent me to say, I was just like, oh my goodness, this is like coercive control beyond belief to me. But what made me really sad was that's me as a woman in 2020 saying that. And unfortunately in the 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, 90s, you know, and until very recently, coercive control and domestic abuse just haven't been either understood or taken seriously or, you know, judged so much. It's very hard. So many different layers in society of how women especially are portrayed and the language that's used around them and things. But back in the 60s, there was so much heat about the kind of you know, the nudist colonies and the threesomes and the foursomes and the partners swapping and at the core of that to me was someone who'd been manipulated and kind of eroded and broken down to a point where she was doing things that she really didn't want to do but went along with. Then I found it hard to leave him because there was children involved that she loved very much. But also, if you're so eroded and diminished, one, you don't believe that you're of any worth, that you'll survive on your own. Then you've got, you know, the whole like money power thing involved because Max was a wealthy man with connections. So many aspects to diminish and keep someone manipulated and groomed. I'm not for a minute saying that, you know, the only way out was murder and that should have happened. But for, as I can imagine, a woman in that situation where you're so diminished, that maybe did feel like the only way out. And I know people would say, well, why not just walk away? Why not leave? And she did attempt to leave. But the kids were still with them and she couldn't cope with leaving them and she wasn't strong enough mentally to leave them. And you know, in a coercive control situation, you're also isolated from the people who know you and would maybe have comments of like, look, this isn't normal behavior, and you know, those flags, if you don't have that, if you have that support kind of gone from you and you're just in this situation that's just become your normality. I felt so many emotions for Sheila, and yeah, I just felt, by looking at the transcripts and looking at the book extracts, that she just was a woman trapped in a kind of hell, had been forced into this relationship with Brian Tevendale, which then develops into a real love. And then to have that kind of, it just was so many aspects. And I'm rambling here, but it's hard, isn't it, to...
No, but you're right. I mean, every time I talk about this case, I ramble because there are so many layers. It is so complicated, and all the details, the devil is in the detail, all the details are relevant and important because they create the picture. And there's so many things I want to pick up on what you said there. I think I'd like to, if you reverse back a little bit to the when you were talking about the court case and, you know, the judgments. And I think you're right. She would have been judged as, you know, acting up or being hysterical because that's how women act. And I think one of the interviewees actually really beautifully put it. She said, as a woman, if you're a criminal, you're either mad or bad. And in this case, you know, Sheila was not regarded as mad, so she must be bad.
Yeah, but that's it.
Mm. And they're not considering, what about her being a victim? And this is the thing that, you know, I think got ignored, and I'm trying to highlight. And again, no one is saying that murder was the answer, but actually she had very, very few options. How did you feel when you discovered that the doctor had... Once she finally confided in her doctor the true reason of why she needed the sleeping tablets and what had been going on, and only when she'd actually been physically assaulted, went to him and then finally revealed about the demands of Max, his sexual perversions, and the first thing he did was call Max up. How did that make you feel?
Oh, it's just, again, that way of someone in that time, in that period, of having no... way exit or that doesn't then end up going back to Max, you know, the kind of connections that he had where you just would feel so betrayed, you know, and how difficult it would have been to say those words and to, you know, confess, you know, the truth of what's going on, and for it just to go back to Max, you're just like, just devastated, because if Sheila had received the right help and an understanding of the situation which she was in, which to me clearly is domestic abuse, grooming, coercive control, but there was no words for that then. And not even until very recently, in the last 5-10 years, I would say, has society and started to have a proper understanding of what grooming and that kind of coercive control, where, I mean, the thing is, it did involve violence as well. It wasn't, you know, mental abuse and you know, manipulating only, it was also physical, and it just wasn't recognized, and if there'd been those kind of things in place, like, you know, those flags or victim support or, you know, women's, you know, aid that she could have got pointed in the direction to and had the support to leave Max and take the children, who knows? I mean, it's difficult because, you know, the love she had for Brian Tevendale was very real as well. And she talked, you know, about that she would love him all her life and that she still loved him now. And when she was questioned in court about, you know, still having sexual relationships with him, she was very clear in the fact that she was in love with him and she would protect him. So so many layers, and certainly not a case of mad or bad, you know. And you know, and maybe because I'm looking at it back in time, I sound very, and I don't mean to be, as if I'm like, yes, and I believe that murder was the answer. I don't mean that, but I can see why it would feel like that if the one time you try and reach out and speak out to, they say, the doctor, and you're betrayed, or, you know, if you're told by someone that you really mean nothing and your opinion means nothing, and, you know, I'm sure she was told she wouldn't survive if she left, and those kind of manipulations. Yeah, she must have felt very trapped.
The criminal behavioural analyst that I spoke to, she said actually there was a number of people that were complicit in this story. And that's so true. The doctor, the police officers, some of them, you know, well, the local bobby that tried to persuade her to go back, the hotel manager, her, even her family. And it was all like, it was almost the opposite. The support was all the other way. It's pushing them back to the abuser. Do you think, though, even though we're talking 2020 and we're able to look back and have a perspective of that, but I still think there are some people listening who still can't place them just as human beings and seeing victim and abuser, and it's still kind of in the negative towards Sheila because that was the times and that's what you did. Do you think there's still a lack of sympathy towards someone like her because it happened at that point in time?
I think things in society are slowly changing for women. But I think, you know, there's a long way to go. And I think there always is a different language and a different talk about women and how they're portrayed in media. And, you know, you go back to witch hunts and, you know, there is still witch hunts that go on. They just go on in kind of social media now. And, you know, there's always a gladiator ring in society. It just changes shape, you know, and at the moment now it's on, you know, social media and that kind of arena. There's something about women and you know, there was a lot made of Sheila's beauty as well, and I was thinking about that today, thinking, you know, if Sheila and Max hadn't appeared so glamorous, and, you know, would there have been the same interest if it'd been a couple that had been living down the road, and, you know, I just, there's this fascination still with beauty. And
I totally agree with you there about the beauty aspect, and I even had a problem with it myself because I was also mentioning her appearance, but the reason it was important, it was her appearance was the reason why people were so fascinated. It's almost like the Princess Diana effect as well. There was this fascination with her because of the way she looked, and Sheila actually had a similar kind of, obviously way before Princess Diana's time, but the similar kind of look, that the you know, her face and her hair and everything. I think you're right. I absolutely love the way you describe that, the gladiator ring. Wow.
Yeah.
That is so on point for, you know, and it's Twitter nowadays instead of the newspapers definitely were. And the thing that I think is so interesting, which also ties in with the beauty aspect, when you see the photographs of those crowds, it is unbelievable. It looks like a football crowd that has just poured out of a stadium. There's a sea of heads, and anyone who's been to Aberdeen or seen photos of it, you would just never get that. And I, as a journalist, and I was speaking to someone else in the industry, you know, crime journalism, and we couldn't really come up with something that we could think of that didn't involve, you know, Michael Jackson's trial. Yes, but that's because it was Michael Jackson and in America. But there's nothing like that that's been here before that attracted that attention, that stopped the farmers' wives from doing their chores that day because they had to read the papers first and they were all eating up. So I think human beings and our fascination with other people's downfall, sadly, is obviously part of us, but it was exactly the same then as it is now. We've just got a lot more of it and it's a lot more accessible. So there's some things we, you know, don't care so much
about. What happens then is the real topic or issue then gets lost because the headlines are talking about, you know, the beauty, or talking about, you know, what Sheila wore to court, or how well she was turned out, or the hairstyle, or, you know, all that. And what's not then getting talked about in the headlines is the, you know, I mean, what Max was, you know, getting, how he introduced the nudist camps and the beaches, and then the pornography, and that was getting sent, and he was ordering the pornography, and the slow erosion of kind of self-worth that she had, and this kind of happy dream of her kind of happy ever after just turned into this very dark, abusive, horrible life, it sounds. I'd actually had a cry today when I listened again to her mum's letter to her. It just made me cry, because it was just so sad, you know, that last letter that was opened when her mum passed away, and just that mother's letter to a daughter, and the love that she had for her. And I just thought, oh, this whole thing is just tragic.
It is. And also in the newspapers, not once is there any wording or language used to acknowledge the fact that she was an abused woman. It was portrayed as being shocking and being pushed naked into a bedroom, but there wasn't anything that was actually portraying sympathy, or this is really wrong against this woman, and this is, you know, a terrible thing, which is again what's why she had the negative kind of focused on her.
There wasn't a language for that kind of coercive control, as we'll say now. There wasn't. I don't even know if people would have thought about it as much, you know, or whether the media and the headlines kind of propelled the story down a certain way. But I just feel in general, it's been a long time in coming to understand just how much kind of grooming can go on in that kind of abuse, you know, and it doesn't always have to be the what you think abuse will look like. And even for the victim, not realizing that actually they've been in a abusive relationship until it's too late, or maybe not seeing it because if things have become so normalized. So it's just much bigger and much more complicated than it being mad or bad. That's what I took from it, and when I first read it, and I just thought, I have to sort of help you tell that story, you know.
You touched on something there which I think is important. Do you think that Sheila actually knew that she was a victim?
See, that's what I don't know if she... I mean, I know that she'll have known that she wouldn't have wanted to do a lot of these things, and, you know, she wasn't comfortable, obviously, with a lot of the sexual stuff that went on and the manipulation of different sexual sort of situations, either with other people or what they did. But I'm sure there'll have also been a lot of, like, blaming herself as well, and then feeling bad of, well, how do I explain? How do I explain to people how I've got into this situation? You know, how do you explain something like that? So there's a very clever way when people like Max, who are coercively manipulating a situation all the time, that he'll have made her feel like a lot of this was her fault, or that she's been part of it all, or that, you know, somehow, you know, she's, you know, manipulated her, you know. It just such a clever way of manipulating that I'm sure a lot of it is then covered in shame of being embarrassed that you're in that situation, and how do you say to a family and your parents or your friends, how do you talk about that? And then how do you talk about it if you've tried with your doctor and then been betrayed? It's almost like, the things that you've worried about would come true if you spoke about them actually did, which is you're somehow still in that situation with the same things happening and no one helping you.
There's more to come. Bear with us for a short ad break.
I'm not expecting you to remember anything verbatim, but were there any pieces that you read, her words, that really touched you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of it struck chords with me. I'm trying to think of any in particular. It was more like... as it started happening, like the things she would talk about with the pornography being sent and the being made to go to the nudist, you know, and just this kind of life, like her kind of life being sapped out of her. And because we are looking at it, you know, looking at the trial and looking at the material from afar, you can see it playing out, and it just made me sad. And as I said, her mum's letter today just broke me, because there was also a lot of pain and blame, and, you know, this kind of situation creates a lot of victims, a lot of people feeling like they could have done something different, or they should have done something different, or why did they do this, or why... You know, I'm sure everyone, I mean, Brian, you know, questioning what on earth he ended up doing, and Alan, and, you know, and then thinking about the children and the damage to them, you know, Wendy and her siblings, and it just so many ripple effects. It just fills me with much sadness.
And her mother actually did acknowledge in her words, I do remember them, she said, "You were never bad, never." So at least her mother at least had that acknowledgement. I think one of the passages for me was actually, I think, the final point, which was, you know, it isn't until you have strayed from what you should have been, what you could have been, etc., basically that you can learn to have compassion, learn to open your heart and your eyes to other people's circumstances, and never to judge. Never to judge until you're in those shoes. And then the horrible irony of that is what happened to her entire life, even when, you know, she's an old lady with Alzheimer's, and the staff were incredibly compassionate. No one gossiped about her or anything, but there was still a curiosity. Ooh, how could this woman have done that? You know, there was a curiosity there of still this. She became an enigma, I think. Her whole life story is the reason why I'm now going to be, fingers crossed, turning into a drama, is I think it is a really important thing for people to, I wanted people to think, and I wanted people who were in their glass houses to suddenly go, oh, okay. And this is why I said at the beginning, you're going to change your mind over and over again, and you will, and they flip-flop throughout the whole thing. Oh no, this person's the bad, this person's bad. And actually what we need to think is turn the gaze upon the gladiator ring and ourselves and say, like, okay, who are we to judge? Have we been in their shoes? Have you ever been a victim of abuse? Do you know how difficult it is to leave? It is not a case of just walking out the door.
And it's not a case of it even being obvious that it is abuse, you know? Like, you know, that kind of slow erosion could be dressed up as an, you know, like... Oh, just, you know, let me know where you are and I'll pick you up from your night out with your friends just so I make sure you get home safely or something. And it could start off, I don't know, you know, like dressed up as if, oh, I'm the person who really loves you and cares for you and would, you know, get up at 2 a.m. and drive to where you are and bring you home. However, that could be a beautiful thing in a healthy, wonderful relationship. But in a coercive relationship, that's how it begins, you know, at the beginning, is it's dressed up as in, like, I love you so much, I do these, you know, and then, you know, so a slow thing. So until it's bad, would you look around and go, how on earth did I get to the point where, you know, I'm not going to think about different examples that people must go through, but it's just not as black and white as going, oh, you know, I've been hit, you know, hitting things. It's just a lot more manipulative than that, to the point of, you know, if it's reached violence or some sort of very, very disturbing behaviour. And back then, not knowing the vocabulary of saying what's happening to you, or then people, you know, much more situation then of people were like, you just put up and got on with things, you know, and so...
Put up and shut up, wasn't it? That was the...
Yeah, put up and shut up and, you know... I just think it's difficult. Of course you would cling to, you know, our love for Brian and feeling like, you know, he was her happiness and
her savior. Yeah. Learning of the fact that she, you know, said that she had hoped that she would see him once he was out of jail, and he, you know, many years later had said that he had also had the same hope. But I think she'd found out that he maybe had some sort of female pen pal. But did you feel sadness that they never met again? They never had a conversation. They were never able to, you know, not that you could ever draw a line on it, but it felt like there was just that it was just left open there. They said goodbye, of course, when they parted, not knowing that 3 months later the love would end. Which I think actually was potentially a part manipulation there, that she was told that he was going to sell their love letters, and he didn't. They were never sold, so he didn't do that. But then also there was the side of, you can completely understand if there's any threat to her, you're not going to see your children if you continue communicating. Of course, what are you going to do? But sorry, back to my question was, well, did you feel a bit sad for them that they didn't get to meet again? Just even as two human beings who'd both been puppets to this puppeteer, and what had happened to them.
Yeah, and just really sad that such a terrible, terrible incident had taken place and someone got murdered. And actually, by the end, like, you know, they didn't... It wasn't like, you know, they kept in contact and reconnected. I just think, do you look back in your life and go, what... How did we get to a point where that seemed like the only way out, you know?
Sad for everyone. And as I said, you know, it's for the victims, basically for all those living, the guilty and the innocent, there was no positive outcome. And actually, though, but what we do forget is that this entire web that involved all these people, the person at the centre of it, the person controlling it, and the person manipulating it, which led to this ripple effect out, was Max. And again, not to, you know, speak ill of the dead, but he was a controlling person, an abusive person, and took pleasure in other people's fear and pain, etc. And, you know, how important is this kind of storytelling to you for, you know, knowing that there might be people listening that could identify with this?
I think it's so important to tell these stories, because like I said, if you know, for some people in a coercive situation may not realize they are, or you know, be able to identify like certain things or traits, or you know, I just think hearing a story that could be your story is a really important thing to do, if only for hoping that, you know, people would feel encouraged, or to maybe have the courage to be able to see if, you know, because there are wonderful organisations and there are wonderful support groups out there, and a lot more understanding from people about situations like this. I just think it would hopefully make people not feel so alone and not feel like like, this is my fault somehow that I've got into a situation like this, because it's done in such a eroding, small, quiet way. It can just be a normality, and it takes an outside eye or someone to go, that's not normal behaviour, or that's not good, or, you know. And for a lot of people that are in situations that are coercive, they've been isolated from their friends and family and people that would say, you know, would see that. And that, and again, that's what happens when someone manipulates a situation just so that you don't have that support network around you. So hearing maybe a podcast like this, or, you know, being able to recognise behaviour traits, could be really helpful, I hope, for some people.
And I wanted to just end on asking you a bit more of a, I know that you're a podcast listener, and you like listening, because obviously when you're acting, there's, you have long periods of time in between scenes, and that's often when you'll be listening to something. But also, you know, from your perspective, I think that acting is so crucial to storytelling. I think sometimes people don't like to learn lessons from documentaries or books. They don't like being preached to, but if you can watch something and be gently swept up in someone else's life and have empathy, then that's a very, very clever way of then having an understanding of someone who's different to you. And I think in the same way, I think there's something about podcasts, because it's so in depth, there's something about the intimacy of being in the ears as well, that people are really invested in them emotionally. And, you know, all the people who write to me, I just think it's such a, and my whole career has been in television news and documentaries and kind of a shorter form of, you know, storytelling, which never was enough for me. So I love this way. But for you, what do you like most about these kind of long form podcasts? Or I like to call mine an audio documentary.
Yeah, I mean, exactly that. And I think it goes back to, like, honestly, like, our whole culture as humans is based on storytelling. It's how you learn about life. It's how you've been, had skills passed down. It's how, you know, when we were wee and you'd have power cuts and, you know, like, my dad would be like, okay, get the candles on, like, tell stories. And, you know, there's something about podcasts being in your ear. It makes it this very personal, oh, I don't know. I get a lot of comfort, and, like, I don't sleep well, so I'll use podcasts or, you know, things like that to help me get to sleep. But yeah, I feel it's, there's something, an audio documentary, I guess, that you can just have in your ears. And also, you don't then have to be sat in one room, you know, in a certain sort of situation. You can take your podcast out and go walks with it. You can go to sleep with it. You can be on a train. You can be on a bus. So it's just such a brilliant kind of mobile storytelling thing, and such a great way of hearing about different human stories, and also opening and broadening your mind in so many ways. So for me, I'm like a wee sponge.
Well, I'm glad you're a fan, and
I'm a very big fan, as you know. And I just think, you know, thank you as a listener, and I'm sure, like, other listeners will feel the same. Like, thank you for, you know, all your efforts and time to sort of elevate Sheila and Melanie's stories and let us as listeners find out about these women and find out about either not knowing anything at all about them or only knowing about the headlines. And it's really important to amplify the voices of these two women. And, you know, cheers, you know, it's been wonderful sort of coming along in this journey with you.
And I mean this sincerely, I could not have told Sheila's story without you. I mean that. I'm so grateful. Because it did add, I was a bit conscious at the beginning of this that so many people were dead. I'm like, oh, how am I going to do this? I did do a little bit of reading out in the last one, but it was just for a small bit in court, which I was able to do. And I was making obvious, like, I'm just going to read out what she said. But for this, I felt it was so important. And then when you said yes, I was just so, thank you from the bottom of my heart, because your contribution, as I say, has been so crucial and so important. So thank you.
And I mean, I could listen to you all day, because you've got an amazing voice to listen to. You really do. And I also wanted to say, I thought all the other actors or people that you've used for voices were brilliant, really good, in the different court trial and the different tones and textures. And I think that you've done an amazing job of kind of bringing that all together. And like I said, when I listened to Sheila's mum's letter again, the woman doing her voice, it just touched me very much. I ended up sort of sobbing in the kitchen. I thought everyone was wonderful that you involved, and I thought you put it together really well. And
thank you. I should mention that a lot of the voice actors, quite a few of them have the surname Traquair. My dad is Lionel Dykes,
and
one of my brothers is Ewan Stewart. But I would like to pay a special tribute to the woman who is the voice of Sheila's mother. She's an angel in my life. Her name's Eleanor Murray, and she's actually a very dear friend to my parents, and she's been an absolute godsend when my mum's been unwell, and she looks after my parents' dogs. She walks them every day, so she's an angel. And when I asked her to do it, because I just thought her voice would be perfect.
Her voice is fantastic.
She did it in like one take, and I'm like, that's perfect. She's like, are you sure? And I'm like, that was perfect. But she's got
beautiful and natural. Yeah, and that, and the letter just broke me, and I thought, wow, that, you know, she's amazing, because it was just such a lovely natural quality, and it didn't feel like, you know, there was too much acting as such going on. It was like people lending their voices to give your story a more texture, and I thought everyone did really well in doing that. Eleanor was great.
She's great. She'll be really chuffed to hear that.
She made me cry. Yeah.
You made me cry when I heard. I told you that when you sent that audio through the first time, and I think I was out walking my dog listening to her somewhere, I can't remember, you just sent it, and I was like, oh my god, and I messaged you immediately going, oh my god, this is just, I'm in tears.
Well, as you know, as an actor, when I listen to it, of course, I say, I wish I'd done. As I said, it was a real honour just to be involved in telling Sheila's story. And thank you again.
And thank you for speaking to me today. I'm sure the listeners will love hearing your perspective on it. I certainly have. Aww. And one of the best things that's come out of this for me is a friendship with you.
We now have this lovely connection. We do. And actually, I'm not going to tell, but we now have a kind of, like, shall we say, like a secret seven club. We won't talk about the name because it's secret, but it does involve you, me and your doggy. So I am loving being part of our little club, and only me and you know the password at the shed door. So I've loved that as well. It's been really nice connecting. We have a very similar sense of humour and outlook in life, and
we're
great.
Pretty sick.
Yes.
We have a sick sense of humour, but we have huge hearts. We have huge hearts, and I think that's why we connected. So Kate, thank you. I know everyone's going to fall in love with you even more hearing you today. So thanks a lot.
But no, it's been lovely chatting to you. Take care.
Isn't she just lovely? And it was so, so special for her to give her time and talent to this podcast, and again for the conversation today. Now, Kate mentioned in there the other voices, and I thought I'd take this opportunity to give them all a mention. As you know, this was recorded during COVID, So it involved people from Scotland and England lending their voices and having to imagine the other person replying to them, which isn't easy. None of them are actors, although I'm sure some of them might fancy it now. I'll start off with the other accused. The voice of Brian Tevendale was by David Nicholson. The voice of Alan Peters was by Rory Laidlaw. Edith Watson Sheila's mother was Eleanor Murray. Trudy Burse was by Deborah Fowler. Fred Burse was by David Harris. One of my big brothers, Douglas, he was the prosecutor, Ewan Stewart QC. Defending Sheila, Lionel Dykes QC, was my father, Ian Traquair. An old colleague of mine, David Marsland, was the voice of Dr. R. Taylor defending Alan Peters. And last but not least was Judge Lord Thompson by one of my old teachers, Bill Nicholson. And I think he was absolutely fantastic. So thank you to all of them who lent their time and their voices to this project. I could not have done it without them. I'm sure you'd have all been thoroughly bored listening to me trying to impersonate all these people. So I really am so grateful. And thank you again, the listeners. Thank you for your support. Thank you for going on and doing reviews and rating this podcast. It makes such a difference. If you haven't already, please, please just take that little bit of time. It makes such a difference. And hopefully I can keep telling more stories. For now, though, from me, goodbye and take care.